Je suggère que nous commencions. Bonsoir à tous et à toutes. Merci d'être venus ce soir pour écouter le Père David Hollenbach. Nous avons beaucoup de chance de recevoir le Père Hollenbach ce soir. David est un compagnon jésuite qui vit aux États-Unis. Donc la conférence qu'il va faire va être en anglais, mais je vous rassure tout de suite, il y a une petite traduction en français pour ceux qui en auraient besoin, que vous pouvez vous procurer à l'accueil, si j'ai bien compris. N'hésitez pas à le faire maintenant si vous ne l'aviez pas et que vous en ayez besoin. Pour les questions et réponses, ensuite, je ferai la traduction en direct pour que tout le monde soit à l'aise. Donc le père Hollenbach a été très longtemps professeur de théologie morale à Boston University, Boston College, qui est une université jésuite à Boston, sur la côte est américaine, où il a dirigé le Centre des droits humains et de justice internationale, où on fait à la fois de la philosophie, de la théologie, puis surtout de l'action politique. Donc c'est un homme qui, pendant sa carrière académique, a toujours essayé de lier à la fois la réflexion académique et un engagement très très fort sur le terrain. Il a enseigné aussi très longtemps à Hekima College, à Nairobi, et donc a une connaissance intime, réelle, profonde, durable de la réalité de l'Afrique subsaharienne. Et puis maintenant, le père Hollenbach est professeur à la Walsh School of Foreign Services de l'université de Georgetown à Washington DC. Donc il est descendu un peu plus au sud, le long de la côte est. Voilà. Et il s'est rapproché du coup, par exemple, de la bibliothèque du Congrès aux États-Unis, qui est, comme vous le savez sûrement, la plus grosse bibliothèque du monde. Et c'est bien ça qu'il fallait pour le père Hollenbach. Alors, ce soir, David va nous parler d'un ouvrage qu'il a publié, en fait, il y a un petit temps déjà, la première version en anglais est sortie en 2002. La version en français est sortie plus récemment. Et donc, vous l'avez ici. Je ne peux que vous encourager, si la conférence vous plaît, à vous procurer cette version. Vous y trouverez l'essentiel de ce que David va dire. Et puis, donc David m'a fait une confidence là tout à l'heure. Une partie de ce qu'il va nous dire ce soir provient également de la réflexion qu'il a menée depuis la publication de ce livre, et donc qui sera publié dans un autre ouvrage qu'il vient de remettre à son éditeur aux États-Unis, qui n'est pas encore publié aux États-Unis, a fortiori qui n'est pas encore publié en français, mais je crois que la qualité de ce que nous allons entendre dans les minutes qui viennent sera une incitation pour nous tous à faire en sorte que le deuxième livre soit également publié en français, aux éditions des facultés jésuites de Paris. Voilà. Je n'en dis pas plus. Nous allons écouter David donc pendant une grosse cinquantaine de minutes, en anglais, mais vous avez la traduction en français, puis ensuite on pourra passer aux questions-réponses. Je souhaite une excellente soirée. David, thanks a lot for being with us. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Gail. I am most grateful to all of you for being here and for putting up with the fact that I speak in English rather than French. I have studied French and can read French, but I am not so good at speaking French since I have never lived in a francophone country. So please put up with my English, and you have the French text, I think, in front of you. So I would like to I was invited to present something in conjunction with the book that I have written about the common good and Christian ethics. But I thought, since this book came out a little bit ago, I would try to add something a bit more contemporary and innovative to what I am saying. And I'm going to try, in light of the current situation we are facing, to address the issue of the global common good in relationship to the rising nationalism that we are seeing in so many parts of the world today, and in particular about the impact of that upon the issue of refugees and displaced people, which is an area that I have been working on in very recent years, and we'll have a book published about the refugee issue from an ethical point of view in another couple of months. It will be coming out. So I would begin by saying I think that it's pretty clear that something has gone wrong in the direction of international affairs these days. The journal in the United States called Foreign Affairs suggested this when it published an issue just about a year ago with the title on the cover that simply said, "Out of order, not working." and suggesting that the international scene is in a situation of disarray. The rise of populist nationalisms that have led to the Brexit movement in the United Kingdom, to the election of Donald Trump in my own country, these are threatening the institutions that were created in the aftermath of the Second World War to try to secure peace and justice, including not only the European Union, but also the institutions that try to regulate economic activity on a more international level. These institutions are being challenged in serious ways by the leader of my own country, as well as parts of Europe as well. And the dangers are also rising in the global south. The former United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayd Raad al-Hussein, a Jordanian, put it this way. He said, "We find ourselves in a political earthquake zone. Weight-bearing pillars of the international system are in danger of collapse. Unprecedented numbers of people are fleeing their homes. Yet rather than dealing with these challenges, we seem to be turning away and looking inwards rather than outwards." Al-Hussein is right. Many of today's rising nationalisms show that nations and peoples are turning inward in many parts of the world. The displacement of refugees is a vivid sign, I think, of the global disorder of our world today. In 2018, in the most recent report on data put out by the High Commissioner for Refugees, it was stated that persecution, conflict, and generalized violence has forcibly displaced 68.5 million individual people worldwide. This is a record high of displacement. And many see the world as divided into the in-group people of their own people to whom they have responsibilities and the out-group of other peoples who are fleeing from their homes to whom many think they owe nothing. Now, there are several causes for this nationalistic turning inward that we see in our world today. Some see European populism and the rise of Trump as due to cultural backlash against the unfamiliar languages, lifestyles, and religions being brought by migrants to their countries. Others see these movements as responses to economic forces linked with globalization and neoliberalism, leading many working people to resentment toward immigrants, whom they see as relying on support from the taxes that they themselves are paying, or perhaps threatening their own jobs. Now, my purpose this evening is not to determine whether cultural or economic pressure is the prime source of the rise of nationalism in our day. My key point is that a sizable number of people today seem to feel so threatened that they are seeking to protect their own well-being, even if this endangers others. To respond more effectively to the refugee situation, therefore, I believe that we must replace this exclusionary nationalist sentiment that is on the rise with increased commitment to the transnational and indeed global common good. But I also believe that to do this, we need to build up the common good at local and regional levels, in local and regional communities, so the members of these local and regional communities do not feel so threatened that they become adversaries of those who are being displaced from elsewhere. My point tonight is going to be that neither rootless globalism nor exclusionary nationalism will respond adequately to the challenges we face. I want to argue that we need to build up the common good locally, regionally, and globally, all at the same time. So, to move into that argument, first a few words about the meaning of this term, the common good. It's a concept with a very rich history, going back to Aristotle and the Stoics before Christ, and with a very rich development in the Roman Catholic tradition. In many ways, during the period of modernity, the Catholic Church has been the prime sustainer of the idea of the common good. But despite this rich history, it is surprising how rarely the meaning of the term the common good has been clarified with any precision. It is sometimes identified with a utilitarian goal of the greatest good for the greatest number. This aggregative understanding of the common good can surely be helpful for the overall gross domestic product of a country can be an important indicator of that country's and society's well-being. It does not, however, this aggregative approach, consider how the overall sum is being distributed. And therefore, it doesn't really answer the question of whether it's a common good that is shared by everyone or not. A second understanding of the common good focuses on the social institutions and conditions that are needed to support human well-being. This approach can be found in Pope John the 23rd's definition of the common good, and I quote, as the sum of those conditions of social life which allow groups and their individual members thorough and ready access to their own fulfillment, stressing the social conditions that allow persons and groups to thrive. A third understanding of the common good draws upon the similarity of this idea to that of the notion of a public good, as this term is used by economists. A public good is a good that is present for all the members of the community when it is present for any of them. If it is absent for some, it is absent for all. More technically, economists say that public goods are non-rivalrous in consumption. We don't compete with each other to share in them. And that public goods are non-excludable. If they're there for anyone, they're there for everyone. They're there for everybody, not just for certain people with privileged access to them. And it's for this reason that they're called public goods. A fourth understanding of the common good is particularly relevant to the tensions between today's rising nationalism and the needs of displaced people, I believe. This understanding sees the common good as relational, similar to the good of friendship. In friendship, persons enjoy a good that they cannot enjoy alone. You can't take friendship and slice it up like a pie, as economists sometimes use the image, and take a piece of it home. If you do that, it's not a friendship anymore. The friendship is essentially shared between people. It's a good that is the relationship itself between the people. Like that, some aspects of the common good exist in the very bonds that bind people together in community, enhancing their well-being through their very relationship with each other. There are, of course, many kinds of relationship among persons. Some are very personal and intimate. On the other hand, Aristotle believed that friendship could take a political form in the relationships among the citizens of a Greek city-state. He called this civic friendship. And today, I would suggest we could call it solidarity, a relationship that binds people together as a we and that leads them to see the good of this we as their own good. Aristotle wrote that such friendships, civic friendships, seem to hold states together. And I would suggest that we could extend this and say that solidarity is needed to hold local communities together, to hold countries together, and even to hold the global humanity together as some kind of community. This solidarity leads members of a community to recognize that their well-being is a shared well-being. The very relationships linking them together with other members of the we that they're part of are key aspects of the common good that they share. These bonds of solidarity, of course, range from the most intimate to the most global. The challenge, then, is to find the appropriate way to relate these diverse forms of solidarity to each other. I would like to suggest that to do that, we need to identify what St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas called an ordo amoris, an order of the loves, or an order of the friendships, an ordering of the solidarities that link us together with other persons. For example, our love for family, our love for fellow citizens, and even our love for members of the human community as a whole. How do we order those loves, those friendships, those relationships to each other? We need, I think, to sustain all of them, from the most intimate to the most global, and the challenge is to find out their appropriate relationship to each other, their appropriate ordering. So that leads me to the second part of what I want to suggest about the ordering of local, regional, and global common goods. Pursuing all of those relationships and common shared goods together and at the same time may seem like a utopian dream. To avoid utopianism in this argument that I'm making, I think we need to clarify the relationships between the multiple dimensions of the common good found in different relationships and communities. The Catholic social tradition addresses this issue by calling upon the principle of subsidiarity. While the Nobel Prize-winning economist, an American woman named Eleanor Ostrom, does this by addressing what she calls polycentric governance. So I want to explore those two ideas and their relationship to the common good and the rise of nationalism that we face today. The principle of subsidiarity, as many of you know, was first set forth by Pope Pius XI in a formal way, and this principle recognizes that people need to be linked together with each other in smaller local communities, as well as in larger and today even global communities. Pius XI argued that smaller nearby communities provide the vital support that can enable people to flourish. Thus, he argued that it is an injustice to assign to a greater and higher association a set of criteria, a set of behaviors that would obliterate and wipe out the more local and more intimate communities that help sustain people. But he also affirmed that because of the changed conditions in many areas of life today, that what was once done by smaller, more local associations can today only be done by larger, more encompassing relationships and communities. Thus, in the context of this refugee issue that I mentioned, responsibilities toward displaced people, it seems to me, falls first on the country and the community of which they are members, of which they are citizens. But if their country of citizenship, their community of membership, fails to protect them, or even worse, attacks them and drives them to flee, the duty of protection and support moves to neighboring countries and to larger regional and international actors. There are duties both to one's fellow citizens and to the forced migrants who need protection through asylum and assistance, I would argue. Neither of these duties is an absolute. Neither of these duties obliterates the other one. The key issue is what is the relative weight of the diverse duties to one's own citizens, one's fellow citizens, versus one's duties toward those who are among the 68 million displaced people in our world today. 68 million people sounds like a lot of people. It's because it is. It's one out of every 114 people on earth are among the displaced today. It's quite an extraordinary number. Eleanor Ostrom, who I mentioned, in 2009, became the first and only woman to win the Nobel Prize for Economic Science. And she has offered a perspective that I find helpful in showing that the importance of action by diverse kinds of communities to overcome the disorder that threatens our political scene today. In her Nobel Prize acceptance speech, Ostrom argued that protecting what she calls common pool resources requires action by multiple institutions, some local, some on the nation-state level, some regional, and some global. It also, she says, requires us to move beyond the idea that the prime actors on the world scene today are simply states and markets. She wants to argue that diverse actors in civil society have to become major players in the global polycentric governance that we need to respond to our situation today. She calls her model polycentric governance precisely because it exists on multiple levels and in diverse sectors of interaction of human beings. And it is well suited, I think, to seeking what we can call the polycentric common good. The common good has multiple centers of focus. The ensemble of shared goods that need to be realized simultaneously in local, regional, and global relationships. Now, Eleanor Ostrom is concerned in her own work on the practical level primarily with environmental issues. So she uses environmental examples to illustrate what she means by polycentrism. Environmentally threatened goods such as forests, oceans, and the Earth's atmosphere are often so large that it is difficult to identify who is using them, and even more difficult for one centralized agency to regulate their use. They need to be managed in diverse ways by diverse agents because they're being used in diverse ways by diverse agents, some governmental, some in the private sector, some local, some regional, and some global. For example, Ostrom notes how the codfish, a fish common on the northeastern coast of the United States and Canada, is being threatened environmentally today. But it has been making a comeback of late because it's being protected polycentrically. by agreements reached by groups of fishermen, people who do fishing in local harbors, but also by agreements hammered out by the state of Maine, a northeast state of the United States, one of the districts of the United States, but also by international agreements between Canada and the United States, and finally, by engagement by the United Nations. So the response to the protection of these fish is operating on many levels in many sectors. A more recent example of polycentrism in action was, I think, the development of the 2015 Paris Agreement on Climate Change. National governments, intergovernmental organizations, and numerous non-governmental agencies, including the Catholic Church, especially through the issuing of the important encyclical Laudato Si by Pope Francis, right on the eve of the Paris discussions. All of these agencies have had a very important effect in helping to create the Paris Agreement of 2015. The states that were party to the agreement committed themselves to nationally determined contributions to greenhouse gas reductions. There was no effort to enforce a single standard on all the countries of the world from above, from some kind of global state, for example. No effort to move in that direction. The Paris Agreement was a promising example of promotion of local, regional, and global cooperation for the common good through polycentric collaboration. The more recent two global compacts on migration and on refugees, each of them approved in December of 2018, just a few months ago, were developed in similarly polycentric ways. Neither of these compacts on migration or on refugees exercises authority from the top down. In fact, neither is binding in international law as a treaty would be binding. Rather, they set forth what they call a cooperative framework for actions by states and many other institutions that will respond to the needs of migrants in the case of the Migrants Compact and refugees in the case of the Refugee Compact. The Global Compact on Refugees expresses, it says, the political will and ambition of the international community as a whole. It seeks implementation, though, through voluntary action by the countries that are sources of refugee movement, by countries that host refugees, and by other countries that should share in the responsibility of aiding the displaced. It calls for action by non-governmental organizations, by the private sector, and by faith communities. The problem of refugee movement is polycentric, and so the responsibility to address it also needs to be polycentric. Now, following the path of shared responsibility proposed by the Global Compact on Refugees, of course, makes significant moral demands on multiple agencies, including states, NGOs, and the church. The behavior of my own country, the United States, shows that response to these moral demands is not in any way guaranteed. Indeed, under Donald Trump, the United States proposes to withdraw from the Paris Accord on climate change. Hasn't done it yet, but he's proposed to do it. The United States refused to even participate in the process that led to the Global Compact on Migration. And along with Hungary, the United States was one of only two countries to vote against the Global Compact on Refugees. These are vivid signs of the turn inward by the United States under Trump. I in other settings, and I can do it, I can say it here because we're in a theological context. Martin Luther once defined sin as being turned in on yourself. This leads me to think that Donald Trump is a very severe sinner. Regrettably, he's not alone, because there are others who are resisting both the compact on migration and on refugees and the Paris Agreement on environmental issues, not leading to the implementation in a way that's necessary. Thus, what I would want to suggest is that we need to strengthen solidarity on multiple levels if we are going to promote the common good in a world where millions of people are on the move. Exclusionary nationalism and hegemonic globalism both need to be resisted. So my final point, the need for priorities in helping us to do that. Finding an order of priorities, or what Augustine and Aquinas call an ordo amoris, that appropriately relates the solidarities we share with fellow citizens to the solidarity we should have with refugees would be a central matter in developing an ethically adequate response to the number of displaced people in the world today. The massive displacement of today calls for us to reflect carefully on the relative weights of our duties to fellow citizens and to displaced persons. At the top of the ordo amoris, or the order of priorities that we need to respect in order to respond to the needs of refugees today, would be a certain set of negative duties not to act in ways that cause displacement. For example, this includes the duty not to persecute or oppress people in ways that cause them to feel they have to flee. There are also stringent duties not to commit aggressive acts of war or undertake indiscriminate attacks on civilians, which are major causes of displacement today. So the moral duty in the area of the refugee situation overlaps very significantly with the moral duties of peace building and the avoidance of unnecessary conflict and human rights violations. But in addition to these negative duties not to oppress and not to carry out violent conflicts that force people to have to flee, there are also some important positive duties. And to highlight these, I want to draw on a mode of analysis that was originally developed in the 1970s in the debate about who had a duty to help eliminate the apartheid regime that separated people of South Africa according to race and ethnicity. Back in those days, in the 1970s, when there was a lot of agitation against the apartheid regime in not only Europe, but in the United States as well, some were maintaining that the duty to overcome this system fell on those who had created it, namely on the white Afrikaners, and that Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the UK and the United States said, that's not our duty because we didn't create the problem. That's the duty of the white South Africans who created it. Several scholars at Yale University, however, argued for a different ethical approach. They argued that under certain circumstances, persons, communities, and institutions can have positive duties to help remedy harms they did not themselves cause. They called their approach the Kew Gardens Principles, because it was developed out of reflection on a situation that occurred in the Kew Gardens section of New York City back in the 1960s, a case that has become rather well known in the study of psychology today. The case was this: a young woman named Kitty Genovese was walking home from work in the Kew Gardens section of New York. She was assaulted, raped, and finally knifed to death while 38 people stood by watching this happen and did nothing. They didn't even call the police. Now, this became a cause célèbre. It was all over the newspapers. And the reaction to this situation was an indication that many people believe the fact that I didn't cause some serious harm doesn't absolve me from taking action to help overcome what has been happening. Drawing on this conviction, these scholars that I mentioned in developing these Kew Gardens principles argues that an agent, a person, a group, a country, can have positive responsibilities to respond to the needs of others that they did not cause when four conditions are present. One, there is critical need. Two, the agent is proximate, nearby the need. Third, the agent has the capability of responding to the need in a positive way. Fourth, the person or group or agent is in some way the one who is the last resort for coming to the assistance of those who are in need. And then a fifth condition has been subsequently added, namely action to take to provide assistance can be carried out without disproportionate harm to the one providing the assistance. So in other words, that it's not an excessively burdensome thing to take action. These criteria, I think, can help us clarify our positive responsibilities in the face of the crisis-level suffering of displaced people today across our borders. For example, there can be little doubt that many people are in grave need of protection in both Syria and South Sudan today. For this need has driven millions of them from their homes. Those in these crisis-torn countries face death and the violation of very fundamental other rights, and they are in flight because of these vulnerabilities. The duty to respond to those needs falls first on those whose proximity to the crisis gives them knowledge of the need and better understanding of how to respond. Thus, the governments of the nations where these crises are occurring and the local communities within those nations bear important prime responsibilities. In South Sudan and Syria, therefore, for example, both the governments of those countries and the opposition forces operating there have negative duties to stop the atrocities that they are causing and positive duties to provide assistance to those being displaced by these conflicts. The duty to take positive action, however, does not end at the national borders of Syria and South Sudan. When people in a neighboring country, or even at a great distance, become aware of the crisis, this awareness leads to what could be called psychological proximity. It puts them in moral proximity to those who are suffering. Now, there has been helpful, though imperfect, response to the duties arising from proximity by the countries bordering South Sudan. The Organization of South Sudan's Neighboring Countries is known as the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, frequently just called IGAD, I-G-A-D. It includes Ethiopia, Somalia, Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and the other countries surrounding South Sudan. The IGAD countries played an important diplomatic role in mediating the conflict that began in South Sudan in 2013, shortly after South Sudan became an independent country, just as IGAD had played an important role in helping to end the conflict between northern and southern Sudan that ultimately led to the independence of South Sudan. Regrettably, economic and political self-interest has sometimes distorted the mediation efforts of some of the members of this IGAD group, some of the neighboring countries to South Sudan. And this has led to the engagement of some countries from outside the region, leading them to join the mediation effort, including the United Kingdom, Norway, China, and the United States, as well as the European Union and the African Union. A sense of moral responsibility arose in these more distant countries because of their proximity through awareness. Their mediation efforts have certainly not been perfect. And I don't want to be misinterpreted here as saying that IGAD has done everything that it should have. It has not. But their efforts have made a difference. South Sudan is far from being out of the crisis that it's been in for the last 4 years, but it has made some progress with some help through the IGAD countries. So, proximity. Third criterion, capability of duties toward how to respond. This also sheds light on the positive duties that reach across borders. In considering this in this issue in, about capability, it has become common to point out that someone who cannot swim cannot have a duty to come to the aid of a child who was drowning if aiding the child would require swimming some distance. Whereas a person who is a good swimmer, who has the capability of aiding, can have a genuine duty to do so. Capability would be the distinction between the duties falling on the swimmer and the non-swimmer in coming to the aid of a drowning child. Today, Syria's proximate neighbors, Lebanon, Turkey, and Jordan, are already, in my judgment, massively overburdened with caring for Syrian refugees. I would maintain that Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey lack the economic or political capability to provide asylum for many more refugees. On the other hand, the resources of the Western nations of Western Europe, North America, and the oil-producing Gulf states give them the capability to receive many more asylum seekers than they are. They also have the capacity to provide economic support for Syria's already overtaxed neighbors of Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, for example. The assistance being provided today for Syria's nearby neighbors by wealthy countries is woefully inadequate. Responsibility to assist displaced people is proportional to the capability of doing so. These responsibilities include granting asylum to more refugees, providing larger opportunities for resettlement, and I would say most importantly, providing economic and other forms of assistance to countries like Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan who are already carrying a disproportionate burden of providing assistance to the displaced from Syria. Now, this argument will be met, of course, both in my own country and probably here in parts of Europe, that the U.S. and Europe are already overburdened by the refugees they have already received, especially since the influx to Europe of over 1 million refugees back in 2015. As Mrs. Angela Merkel can probably tell you, there's been a significant uprising against her willingness to admit those millions. The arrival of Syrians in Germany has produced a significant backlash there. And that backlash flowed over into the Brexit campaign, leading to what has happened with the vote on Brexit, and where that finally gets settled in the next 3 weeks remains to be seen. It has considered to created this significant backlash from our countries and in the United States. All you have to do is look at the debate about the so-called wall between the United States and Mexico to know that there's a lot of resistance to admitting more people seeking asylum in my country as well. But several points need to be made in relationship to that argument. First, I would argue that Europe, the United States, and the Gulf oil-producing countries have considerably greater capacity to respond to the needs of displaced people than do the countries that are already doing so. The number of Syrians seeking asylum in Europe is not even close to the number already within the borders of Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. Today, in Lebanon, one out of every four persons inside the borders of that country is a refugee. One out of six are Syrian, and the rest are mostly Palestinian. In Jordan, one out of every three people inside the country is a Syrian refugee. We haven't come close to that kind of proportion in my country, and I don't think even Germany, with the large number of refugees from Syria that were admitted in 2015, have come close to that proportion. Now, it is not surprising when the 2015 influx into Germany took place, Mrs. Merkel invited the rest of European Union to share the burden. And then Prime Minister David Cameron in the United Kingdom announced that they would live up to their responsibilities and that the UK would admit an additional 20,000 refugees from Syria over the next 5 years. At the time, he was thanked by the Interior Minister of Lebanon for his generosity, but the minister replied to him that, Mr. Cameron, it would be well for you to note that we in Lebanon admitted that number of Syrian refugees over the last two weekends. Indeed, today, developing countries host 85% of the world's refugees, and the very poorest countries of our world are hosts to one-third of all the refugees in our world. The rich nations of the North have sizably greater capability and therefore greater responsibility to admit larger numbers of asylum seekers, it seems to me. In my judgment, Germany followed the right path in admitting 1 million refugees in 2015. Despite this admirable openness, however, Germany is still not carrying as large a burden in proportion to its population or its wealth as is being borne by Syria's neighbors or by very poor Uganda. Uganda is hosting over 1.5 million South Sudanese refugees today. Basic fairness suggests that richer countries with greater capacities have a duty to help in ways that go beyond what we are doing. This means greater openness to granting asylum. It also means especially providing assistance to the poorer countries who are already hosting most of the world's refugees to help them carry out that duty that they've already taken on. Secondly, I think it means responding to the fact that taking into account the fact that admitting refugees does not necessarily and frequently does not at all create significant burdens for host countries. In my country, for example, the data indicate that refugees make contributions to American society rather than placing added burdens upon it. The median income of refugees who have come to the United States is the same as the median income of those born in the United States on average, and therefore refugees pay equivalent taxes to indigenous United States citizens. Indeed, the employment rate for refugees in the United States is actually higher than the employment rate for indigenous persons. And thus, refugees do not place a greater burden on the social welfare system, as some people maintain they do, at least certainly not over the average. The claim that some refugees could well be terrorists is also in part misdirected, it seems to me. In my country, those who have been involved in violent terrorist actions have all been U.S. born. There has not been a single refugee involved in any action that could be judged terrorists. Communicating facts such as these can help the nations of the global north overcome some of the racial and religious and cultural stereotypes that lead to the false belief that denying asylum to refugees will enhance security for the indigenous population. One final point. On the other hand, it is true that the inequalities in many of the countries of the world, including the North Atlantic, are substantial and have been growing. Indeed, the 2018 World Inequality Report by Emmanuel Saez, Thomas Piketty, and several other very important students of this issue of inequality indicates that in North America and Europe, the income growth of low and middle income groups has been at or close to zero, while the top 1% in our countries in Europe and the United States have gained considerably more than those lower down on the totem pole. This inequality report also shows that the percent of national wealth that is privately owned has been increasing and the percent held publicly has been declining. This means the richer countries of the North have declining capacity to provide public goods needed by those with less. Thus, Saez, Piketty, and their co-authors conclude that in the European Union and the United States, those who are not in the top 10% in their ownership of wealth are being economically squeezed. Now, this squeezing that's happening for many of those who are not at the very top is one of the reasons why many of these people are subject to being manipulated by demagogues to think that the solution is opposition to refugees and migration. Demagogic populists and nationalists have found ways to manipulate the anger of some of those who have not benefited from the growth of our societies and manipulate that anger to it in a way that directs it against refugees. To overcome the squeeze that is causing real suffering for the working class and the poor, the right target should be rising inequality in the U.S. and the European Union, not refugees seeking asylum from conflict in much poorer countries. Responding to the urgent needs of refugees calls for the promotion of economic growth in richer countries, growth that is common and truly shared by all. A more equal sharing in the good of economic growth in our northern wealthier countries will help reduce the vulnerability of those with less that makes them subject to manipulation into becoming adversaries of forced migrants whose very lives are on the line. This again shows that the common good is truly polycentric. To pursue the common good in a way that benefits refugees also means pursuing the common good in a way that benefits those being squeezed by inequality in our northern hemisphere countries. Both the good of those with less in the rich countries of the north and those fleeing persecution and in the countries generating refugees in other parts of the world have to be pursued simultaneously. That's what, again, I would call polycentric focus of the common good. Authentic political leadership will help those in the United States and the European Union recognize that both of these aspects of the common good, those who are fleeing from conflict in poor countries and those who are being squeezed by inequality in our northern countries, both of these dimensions of the common good need to be pursued together. The Catholic tradition, in my judgment, has long known that the promotion of the common good is a central requirement of justice. This tradition, through its commitment to both subsidiarity and solidarity, also knows that the common good makes moral and religious demands on both the local and the global levels. For this reason, our churches in the European Union and the United States need to work to help strengthen the solidarity of our members, both with refugees and with those being squeezed by growing inequality. Pursuing that goal is really important because millions of lives are at stake. Thank you.
So thanks a lot, David. We have more than half an hour. Nous avons plus d'une demi-heure pour pouvoir discuter entre nous. Donc, ce que je vous propose, c'est qu'on vous puissiez adresser vos questions au père Hollenbach. Je suggère qu'on prenne deux, trois questions et ensuite, I suggest that we take a pool of two or three questions and then you answer to the questions. Donc, la parole est à vous. Vous pouvez lever la main et je traduis en anglais pour David si vous avez besoin d'une traduction. Sinon, vous pouvez vous poser la question directement en anglais, comme vous voulez. Sentez-vous libre. Voilà. Allez-y.
So, Gail can have a little time to translate for me. But first on the first and third questions about really about causes, about why are there, and I would suggest that addressing these causal sources of refugee displacement is crucial. I agree very much with the suggestion that you make about the need to address the reasons why people are compelled to flee. There are complicated questions about why people are being compelled to flee from in different parts of the world. I agree with you. The involvement of the United States in what happened, the attack in Iraq, which destabilized all of Iraq. Saddam Hussein is not an admirable person. But he was keeping at least some kind of stability in Iraq. But the United States' engagement there caused that to fall apart, which flowed over into Syria, and the creation of the Islamic State, and a whole range of other issues came to the fore in a way that I would blame on the attack that took place in Iraq under George Bush, the younger Bush. Bush's father and his advisors recommended against doing that. There were strong reasons. Jim Baker, who was the Secretary of State under the elder George Bush, was very forceful in arguing against what the younger Bush did in Iraq and so forth. And I would say the same thing. My paper makes some reference to the need for avoiding forms of military action that create chaos in those circumstances. And I would fully agree with you on that. And that's part of the issue of addressing causes, of not creating wars that are leading to this massive displacement. I would not say, however, that all interventions are always wrong. You mentioned Libya. My view of the Libya situation and the tragic outcome that has occurred there is that the intervention in Libya was not sufficient. Not that it shouldn't have occurred at all. The United States and NATO went into Libya, and as soon as Muammar Gaddafi was removed from office, they pulled out. There is a duty in the responsibility to protect, which was invoked to justify the intervention in Libya. A duty to help reconstruct a society. You don't go into a country and just pull out when you, we created a situation that's worse by doing that. I would argue because of the intervention not being sufficient. Anyway, that's, but in addition, I would say there are a whole host of other causes for refugee displacement apart from these war issues. I mean, the conflict that's going on in Sudan, South Sudan, is heavily due to the political rivalry between two men, Salva Kiir, the president, and Riek Machar, who was the vice president and was leading the opposition. Their personal rivalry created a situation that led to the tearing apart of that country, and it fractured according to ethnic lines. It was not the result of an intervention from outside. And as a result, we have a responsibility to grapple with that and find ways to help put it back together again. I would also say that what's going on in Burma or Myanmar with the displacement of almost 1 million Rohingya is not due to external intervention. There may be some hangover from British colonialism in Burma that's involved in it, but I don't see a direct intervention as the cause of that displacement. And that's another major displacement. And that's where we have to find a way to address those kinds of causes, getting at the root issues. One last point, and that's the gentleman over here about rights and the common good. I agree fully. I have a personal way of liking to define human rights that ties them directly to the notion of the common good. I like to think of human rights as the minimum conditions for sharing in the common life of society. I like to think of rights as about guaranteeing people's ability to participate in the community. So free speech, for example, the right to freedom of speech, is not the right for me to sit alone in my office talking to myself. It's the right to be engaged in communication with people. It's the right to participate. And I would say the economic well-being of people is all about their right to participate in the well-being of the community, and that the opposition of that participation is exclusion. And exclusion or marginalization is the beginning of human rights violations. So I would see the rights and the common good going together, not being alternatives to each other. And that way, I think we can get beyond an individualistic understanding of human rights to see that human rights are all about sustaining community as well as sustaining the dignity of individual persons. Anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
You need to translate a lot.
Non, non, it's okay.
Sorry.
Donc, je reviens rapidement sur la réponse de David. Premièrement, la réponse aux questions 1 et 3 sur les causes, vous vous en souvenez. Donc, David dit, en effet, c'est absolument crucial de s'intéresser aux causes des migrations ou du départ des réfugiés. Et puis, il se lance ensuite dans un certain nombre d'exemples en disant, vous savez, la question est compliquée. C'est vrai que l'intervention des États-Unis en Irak a provoqué la déstabilisation du pays et d'une bonne partie du Moyen-Orient. C'est elle qui a provoqué notamment la naissance de l'État islamique, qui ensuite est allé s'installer en Syrie. Et d'une certaine manière, bien que évidemment David n'a aucune sympathie pour Saddam Hussein, Saddam Hussein garantissait une certaine stabilité du pays. Voilà. David rappelle que l'intervention en Irak, la deuxième, celle de George Bush fils, avait été réalisée sans l'assentiment et sans les recommandations, et contre en fait les recommandations de George Bush père et de ses conseillers, en particulier de Jim Baker, qui était très hostile à l'intervention, à la deuxième intervention en Irak. Voilà. Et donc ceci, évidemment, fait partie de ce qu'il a mentionné au tout début de son intervention, à savoir qu'il y a un certain nombre de choses qu'il ne faut pas faire, si vous vous en souvenez, qui font partie des devoirs de ne pas nuire, et donc ne pas engager des actions militaires qui provoquent le chaos et la fuite des réfugiés, le déplacement des populations martyrisées. Ça, ça fait partie de nos devoirs de ne pas agir. Voilà. En revanche, David dit, il y a un certain nombre d'interventions, pense-t-il, qui ne sont pas mauvaises. Pour ce qui est de l'exemple de la Libye, dans lequel, vous savez, nous, la France, on a joué un rôle caractérisé, la position de David est de dire, en Libye, en fait, nous ne sommes pas allés assez loin. Les États-Unis et l'OTAN se sont retirés trop tôt, une fois, finalement, que Muammar Kadhafi était renverser. En revanche, nous aurions dû rester pour reconstruire la société. On ne peut pas simplement se permettre de renverser le dictateur et ensuite de partir. Il faut aider à la reconstruction du pays. En nous retirant aussi vite, nous avons contribué à la déstabilisation de la Libye. Et puis, il y a beaucoup d'autres conflits, mentionne David, dont les causes ne sont pas liées à une intervention extérieure. Donc, c'est pas toujours une intervention extérieure qui est responsable du problème. Quelques exemples, le Sud-Soudan, donc la guerre au Soudan, est essentiellement due, d'après David, à une rivalité entre le président ce qui est aujourd'hui le Nord-Soudan, et son ancien vice-président. Rivalité personnelle qui ensuite est devenue une rivalité ethnique et qui a conduit à la fracturation géographique du pays. Puis, en Birmanie, le déplacement d'un million de Rohingyas n'est pas dû non plus à une intervention extérieure. Donc deux exemples de situations où vous avez des déplacements massifs qui ne relèvent pas d'un interventionnisme militaire destructeur. Et puis la réponse de David à la question qui avait été posée par Jean-Marie Carrière, est-ce que les droits humains ne feraient pas partie de la définition du bien commun? Donc la réponse de David, c'est oui, bien sûr. Et d'après David, au fond, il n'y a pas de contradiction. Au contraire, il y a une syntonie entre les droits humains, honorer les droits humains d'un côté, et faire la promotion du lien social, puisque vous vous souvenez que sa troisième définition du bien commun, c'était le bien commun, c'est la capacité à entrer en relation avec autrui, l'amitié étant l'expression privilégiée de cette relation. Donc, au fond, David dit, moi, je définis les droits humains comme les conditions minimales pour que chacun puisse partager une vie commune dans la société. Share a common life in society. Du coup, le droit d'expression, par exemple, c'est pas simplement le droit de prendre la parole tout seul devant son miroir ou dans sa chambre, c'est le droit de communiquer avec autrui, donc d'entrer en relation avec autrui. Les droits sociaux, la deuxième génération de droits humains, ce sont les droits qui permettent à chacun de participer au bien-être de la société et donc d'entrer en relation avec autrui. Et d'une certaine manière, l'exclusion, ce sont les prémices de la violation des droits humains. De sorte que les droits humains et le bien commun avancent main dans la main, selon David. Voilà. Alors, on prend une deuxième série de questions. Can you translate or should I do it? Okay. Donc, la personne qui pose la question dit, au début de votre intervention, vous avez mentionné à la fois le principe la question de la solidarité et le principe de subsidiarité. Or, si je prends l'exemple du réchauffement climatique, vous savez bien que le réchauffement climatique est essentiellement dû aux pays du Nord, mais que aux émissions de gaz à effet de serre des pays du Nord, mais que les principales victimes se trouvent dans le Sud globalisé. Donc comment est-ce que dans cette situation-là, où la victime n'est pas la même que, ou n'appartient pas au même groupe que le responsable, comment est-ce que vous appliquez le critère de subsidiarité? David, is that fine for you?
Okay. Couple things. Let me start with the first issue about the issue of whether borders are being defended too vigorously by, say, the American bishops. I think you highlighted that and it's not only the American bishops who have done this, it's in Vatican documents also. They want to say that we have this very global responsibility for refugees and migrants, but they also say, we don't mean to say that we're in favor of open borders. And I don't either. I don't want to say that the national obligations that we have to our fellow citizens don't mean anything. I think they do mean something. But the big question is how to put these things together. And what I was trying to do in the latter part of my presentation with those principles called the Kew Gardens principles was to try to outline how we can develop some sense of priorities. We have to be responsible for our own fellow citizens in France, in the United States, but if those elsewhere are in grave need and we are capable of assisting and we can do so without unnecessary, extraordinary burdens being disproportionate burdens, then we have a responsibility to be responsible to those outside. I would make the same argument about a family, that I have a special responsibility to my children. And it doesn't mean to say that family borders, that there are concerns about loving my neighbor in Bangladesh means I don't have any worry about my family. I have to protect my children, care for my spouse. So there are responsibilities, but they're not absolute. The importance of marriage and then family life does not mean that it's the only value. There are values elsewhere. And putting these together is a very important question, and how to do that calls for balancing goods that are sometimes may call me to say that I have a responsibility to provide for the education of my children, and therefore I can't give as much to the poor as I would like otherwise to do. So but that doesn't mean I have no obligations to care for those who are refugees or are poor. So finding ways of putting these things together as a balancing is a tricky question from an ethical point of view. And I don't think you can say it's all family or it's all others or it's all nation and or just international. It's neither of those, and we need both of them. The other question about solidarity, I agree with you. There's a real danger that being members of groups can become exclusionary. And I hope that it was clear that my commitment to the notion of solidarity was advocating that we need to avoid that kind of narrowly defined solidarity. Especially, that's why I kept trying to say that there are multiple forms of solidarity that we have obligations to the solidarity with fellow citizens, but also to solidarity, the common human family. We're all brothers and sisters together in the one human family that's called the human race. And we have duties that are reaching out there. But I'm trying to find a way to take into account the multiple demands that are involved here from an ethical point of view without oversimplifying it. And I think hopefully it's clear that I'm not advocating a kind of solidarity that simply says we're the only ones that count. I want to be arguing for the other direction. Now, the question then about applying subsidiarity in the area of climate change, I would say that the argument that someone like Eleanor Ostrom makes is wanting to say the principle of subsidiarity is a principle that's supposed to govern the structure of the European Union. And it's in the documents that founded the European Union and outlined there. And it says that the individual states and the individual nations that make up the European Union should act unless the Union as a whole can act more creatively and more effectively. And subsidiarity means we don't want Brussels telling everybody in France what to do. But when Brussels needs to be involved to help coordinate the activities that are going on, let's say, on developing an adequate refugee policy for the European Union so that all of the burden doesn't fall on one country rather than that, finding ways of a coordinated approach that appeals to the larger structures of institute is needed to go beyond what the individual nations can do by themselves. And that's where I think the subsidiarity principle comes into play. It's saying local is better, but local is not the only way to deal with things, especially when more regional, like European Union-oriented approaches, are needed to respond. Now you can apply that to refugees. You can apply it to climate change, that when local countries should take action to address the climate issues, they should do so. But when international coordination or regional coordination is needed in order to make it work, then you have to move to the regional or the international level. And that's the way I think those principles are to be played out in the area of climate change.
Okay, thank you, David. I'll briefly translate. Alors, sur la première question, donc est-ce que les évêques américains ont tort d'insister trop sur les frontières? Donc David répond au fond, il ne faudrait pas se méprendre sur le sens de ce que j'ai dit. Nous avons aussi une responsabilité vis-à-vis de nos concitoyens. En France, on a une responsabilité vis-à-vis des citoyens français, aux États-Unis, des citoyens américains. Mais ce que j'ai essayé de faire, c'est à travers les Kew Gardens Principles, donc les principes, vous vous souvenez, dans l'intervention de David, autour de cette femme qui, en 1964, a été violée dans le Kew Gardens, puis assassinée. Et donc, ces cinq principes qui sont, y a-t-il un besoin critique? Est-ce que je suis proche de des victimes ou de la victime, je étant éventuellement un État? Est-ce que je peux agir? Est-ce que je peux agir sans mettre en cause de manière disproportionnée ma propre survie? Alors, dans ce cas-là, j'ai un devoir, d'agir, d'intervention. Donc, David répond, finalement, en essayant d'élaborer ces principes-là, j'essaie de donner des critères qui permettent de pondérer entre le devoir que j'ai de soutien vis-à-vis des citoyens dans mon pays et le devoir que j'ai vis-à-vis des, par exemple, réfugiés qui arrivent à ma frontière. Il ne s'agit ni de privilégier de manière unilatérale uniquement les citoyens de mon pays, ni de privilégier de manière unilatérale uniquement les réfugiés, mais de trouver la juste pondération entre les deux. Et les critères de Kew Gardens essayent de fournir cette pondération. De la même manière, par analogie, il en va de même pour un père de famille qui dit « moi j'ai la responsabilité de soutenir mes enfants », ce qui est vrai, mais ça ne veut pas dire que sa famille soit le seul principe qui doit guider son action. Il a aussi une responsabilité d'hospitalité vis-à-vis d'autrui hors de la famille. Mais comment est-ce que justement il arbitre entre la responsabilité qu'il a vis-à-vis des enfants et vis-à-vis des personnes qui sont hors de la famille? Donc c'est cette pondération, cet arbitrage éthique que David essaie justement de formaliser à travers notamment les Kew Gardens Principles. Sur la deuxième question, donc David dit évidemment, je suis très conscient du fait que appartenir à une communauté peut devenir excluant. Et disons, on pourrait dire, ça c'est moi qui le rajoute, hein, tout le débat sur le communautarisme américain porte là-dessus. Et bien évidemment, dit David, il faut chercher à tout prix à l'éviter. Donc, d'une certaine manière, je trouve que la réponse que fait David à la deuxième question rejoint celle de la première. Il existe différentes formes de solidarité. Au niveau de la famille, hors de la famille, dans la société. Et là, de nouveau, je dois apprendre à pondérer et articuler ces différents types de solidarité. Sur le troisième point, vous vous en souvenez, la troisième question qui avait été posée, subsidiarité et changement climatique, David répond, prenons l'exemple de ce qui se passe dans l'Union européenne. Le principe de subsidiarité tel qu'il a été défini dans l'Union européenne, c'est sur tout sujet de politique publique, un pays doit agir, sauf si, l'échelle communautaire pouvait se révéler plus efficace que l'échelle nationale. Et donc, finalement, la réponse de David, c'est de dire on devrait appliquer la subsidiarité en ce sens-là, à la fois pour les réfugiés, la question de l'accueil des réfugiés en Europe, en premier lieu, c'est chaque pays qui doit agir, sauf si une coordination de l'accueil des réfugiés au niveau communautaire se révélait plus efficace. Et puis, pour ce qui est du climat, chaque pays doit agir, sauf si une coordination régionale ou internationale se révélait plus efficace que l'action individuelle d'un État souverain. Voilà. Alors, est-ce qu'on a... We still have 2 minutes, so I suggest to take just one question, the last question. Allez-y, monsieur. Ok, I will translate it.
Is obviously extremely important. And where to draw the line between being a refugee and being an economic migrant can be sometimes very difficult. There's a man who is in Oxford University, the University of Oxford. His name is Alexander Betts. And he has written a very stimulating book called Survival Migrants, in which he wants to say that the definition of refugees does not incorporate all those who are in grave danger of facing their lives being profoundly jeopardized. He likes to use the term survival migrants. That would include, in his judgment, anyone whose most fundamental rights are being threatened. Now, a refugee technically is someone who is being persecuted and has fled across an international border. Someone fleeing from urgent hunger is not a refugee in that regard. But if someone is fleeing because of a severe famine They're a survival migrant in the way that Betts would describe them. And now the question becomes then, should we try to go back and revise the Refugee Convention and change the definition to move it from fleeing persecution to fleeing for one's survival or most fundamental rights? Betts is nervous about saying that he wants to revise the Refugee Convention, because he thinks that if we try to do that, given the attitudes politically in the world today, most countries will try to make it more restrictive rather than more welcoming. And so the argument then would be that we need to find ways, leaving the Refugee Convention the way it is, to take additional actions to assist people who are coming, who are fleeing for other reasons than being refugees. And that's a moral challenge that could rise up for not only for governments, but also for NGOs and for faith-based communities and for a variety of others. I'm a little nervous about saying, let's rewrite the Refugee Convention, because I'm afraid if we tried to do that, it would not move in the direction that you want it to go. It would go the other way. Now, that's one. Then the question about the role of religion in this area. I'm not familiar enough with the evangelical arguments that are being made here in France, for example, to know how to respond to that question in a French context. I can tell you in the United States that there are a substantial number of more evangelical Protestant people who have moved in opposition to welcoming more migrants and refugees to the United States, but that the evangelical and Protestant community, the evangelical community, the more biblically based oriented Protestant groups, there are also those that are very favorable to receiving more refugees and more asylum seekers, and aiding and opposing the building of the wall down between the U.S. and Mexico and so forth. So in the United States anyway, there's a significant division between Protestants about this. There's also a significant division among Catholics, if you look at the polls of Catholic attitudes, because many Catholic lay people who are in this more less educated white population are very anti-migrant and anti-refugee, despite the fact that it goes against the teachings of the church on this sort of thing. But it's because they're in this sense of vulnerability and they're being manipulated by the kind of demagoguery. Some of them voted for Trump in sizable numbers. There's a division religiously. I think the leadership of the Catholic community has been very forceful on this. And in the Protestant community, there have been leaders going in both directions in the United States. I don't know how to respond to that situation here in France, because I just don't know enough about it. So.
Alors, sur la première question, la distinction entre les réfugiés proprement dit et par exemple les migrants économiques, David répond évidemment, la question des migrants économiques, c'est une question très très importante. Tracer la ligne de partage entre les réfugiés d'un côté et les migrants de l'autre est une opération très compliquée. Et David cite à ce moment-là un collègue de l'université d'Oxford qui s'appelle Alexander Betts, qui a publié un livre dont le titre est « Survival Migrants », donc les migrants en survie, et qui reconnaît que la définition actuelle des réfugiés dans la Convention internationale sur les réfugiés n'inclut pas les personnes qui n'ont pas été persécutées et qui fuient, par exemple, parce qu'elles n'ont rien à manger, pour des raisons strictement économiques. Alors, une fois qu'on a dit ça, David dit on pourrait être tenté de vouloir entrer dans un processus de révision de la Convention, et plus précisément de la définition des réfugiés dans la Convention. Mais, il précise immédiatement, le collègue Betts et lui-même d'ailleurs sont assez nerveux à cette idée, parce que le contexte politique actuel est tellement, tourmenté, que si on s'engageait dans cette procédure-là, il n'est pas impossible qu'un certain nombre de pays en profiteraient pour non pas rendre la définition du réfugié plus hospitalière, mais au contraire pour la rendre plus restrictive encore qu'elle n'est aujourd'hui. Et donc plutôt que de prendre ce risque-là, la position de David, c'est de dire, et celle de Betz, c'est de dire, engageons-nous, enfin, augmentons, accroissons les actions sur le terrain qui permettent d'accueillir des migrants qui ne sont pas formellement des réfugiés au sens de la Convention. Faisons-le à titre éthique, et non pas parce que la Convention nous y engage, et n'essayons pas de réviser la Convention. Sur la deuxième partie de la question, le rôle des religions dans tous nos débats, David rappelle qu'aux États-Unis, au fond, les différentes confessions chrétiennes sont elles-mêmes très divisées. Dans le camp protestant, si je puis dire, il y a des communautés évangéliques qui sont devenues très hostiles à l'accueil des migrants mexicains, mais vous avez aussi des communautés évangéliques protestantes qui se montrent très hospitalières, qui sont très opposées, par exemple, à l'érection du mur entre les États-Unis et le Mexique. De la même manière, vous avez une division très forte à l'intérieur des catholiques. Donc David rappelle qu'il y a un certain nombre de laïcs catholiques blancs, pauvres, éventuellement peu éduqués, qui sont eux-mêmes finalement devenus hostiles à une politique d'accueil des migrants, même si en réalité, en prenant cette position-là, ils s'opposent à l'enseignement social de l'Église, mais probablement qu'ils ne le savent pas, probablement qu'ils sont eux-mêmes manipulés par les leaders politiques pour lesquels ils votent, et en particulier pour Trump, puisqu'une partie d'entre eux ont pris position en faveur de Trump. Voilà. Pour ce qui est de la situation européenne ou française en particulier, David dit, voilà, je ne la connais pas assez bien pour pouvoir vous répondre sur le contexte français. Voilà. David, I have to thank you warmly because this was just beautiful and wonderful for us. Thanks a lot. Voilà, donc un petit récapitulatif. Vous avez toute la première partie de l'intervention de David dans ce livre-là. Je ne peux que vous recommander de le lire. Vous y trouverez en particulier une synthèse, à mon avis, très très bien faite sur l'ensemble du débat à la fois théologique et philosophique sur ce que c'est que le bien commun, avec des rappels liés à la fois à la grande tradition de l'Église, Saint Thomas, Saint Augustin, et puis au magistère ecclésial le plus récent, et un certain nombre d'exemples pris dans l'actualité américaine la plus récente. Voilà. Et puis la deuxième partie de l'intervention de David, qui portait davantage sur la question spécifique des migrants, sera traitée donc dans un livre qui va paraître, et que j'espère nous traduirons bientôt en français, évidemment, aux éditions des facultés jésuites de Paris. Voilà. Merci beaucoup et à très bientôt.
Well, thank you. Todd, good to see you again. Yes, indeed. I didn't know I'd run into you over here. Yeah, that's great. How are you? Very well, thank you. Very well. Thank you. Thanks a lot, Paul.
When you leave Europe, when you leave?
I'm leaving on Thursday morning. I'm going back to Washington. Straight directly back. I'm here tomorrow, but then back on Thursday. I am, yes, indeed. He's doing very well. He's still writing, yes. He's he's an amazing man. He has a book that came out on Vatican I. Now he has another book that's not out yet, but it will be out soon, comparing the three councils, Trent, Vatican I, and Vatican II. All three of us. It is, yes. Great to be with you. Thank you for being here. Hello. Oh, well, that's excellent. I'd be glad to sign it. Do you want me to do that? Sure.